Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, does New Mexico face a water crisis, or all those ominous headlines just an attempt to get our attention? We'll ask UNM professor and longtime Albuquerque Journal reporter John Fleck, author of the book Waters for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West. Professor John Fleck, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And so after all those years as a journal reporter, which you no longer do, I'm just wondering, why this book? Why did you decide to write this book?
I have always been fascinated by the Colorado River ever since I was a kid. And so I've always wanted to write about the Colorado River. I also have always wanted to work at a book length. I worked for newspapers for, 30 years, my whole adult life. And the newspaper, you're working at 600, 800, 1,000 word lengths, and you have the opportunity to write about a subject again and again and again, but in little short snippets. I have always wanted to work at a longer length, and the opportunity to do a book was always really attractive to me.
But why this particular book?
And I was particularly interested in the Colorado River because I grew up as a journalist in the 1980s, writing about water in Southern California at the time of Cadillac Desert, Mark Reisner's classic book about, as the subtitle puts it, the American West and its disappearing water. And I'd always wanted to pick up that theme and extend it.
It has kind of a negative take on what's going to happen in the West in that book.
It has a very negative take.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of apocalyptic narrative.
It's a well-written book.
It's a terrific book. Reisner is a great writer. It's a terrific book, and it really shaped my thinking for a long time. And so I imagined that my work in journalism and newspaper journalism, and then, my hope to write eventually a book about this stuff, would sort of pick up where Reisner left off and extend the story, talk about where we've come in the years since he wrote the book. As I worked on water as a reporter at the Albuquerque Journal, I kept preparing for and preparing my readers for the apocalypse, the running out of water, and one of the things that
that's sort of Cadillac Desert, right? Why are we having all this irrigated agriculture in these large cities where they don't belong in the West?
Yeah, and that's what Mark Reisner was talking about. And Mark Reisner described a world where we're essentially headed for a big crash. And what I found in my work in the newspaper, as I kept looking for the crash, was that rather than the crash happening, what I found was people adapting to use less water, people changing their behaviors. And it was as if the world Reisner was describing when he published Cadillac Desert in the mid-1980s had changed away from that narrative. And there was this new narrative that I think is really important to talk about. It's people adapting, people conserving, people using less water, and doing it in a way that sort of preserves the culture of the cities and the farm towns and the rural areas in the West that we so love, in a way that we don't have to have conflict and battle and an apocalyptic crash. And that became a story that was really compelling to me. It's less dramatic. It's happening slowly and in many interesting places and in many interesting ways, but I think it's a different narrative. And as a journalist, I'm really interested in narrative, the stories we tell. It's sort of the journalistic version of a paradigm in science.
That's what gets readers interested in the subject, right? A story of some kind.
So you have a narrative, which is this sort of overall structure that then you can slot individual stories in, and we still had this narrative of a looming apocalypse. And I realized that the narrative was different. And that's why I wanted to sort of leave daily journalism and really work out that narrative in detail in a book form.
So later in the show, I want to push back a little bit on the idea that water really isn't worth fighting over and that there aren't a lot of fights going on. But I think the thing that listeners most would like to know about is, like, what's the situation in New Mexico and what's the situation in Albuquerque? And I wonder if we could start in Albuquerque and just talk about what's our water situation.
So Albuquerque, the municipal water supply system, the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority, it was formerly a city agency, and now it's a joint powers authority among the city and the county created by the legislature of the state of New Mexico, used to get all its water from groundwater. We were pumping our aquifer down and down and down. The aquifer beneath the city was dropping you know, 100, 120 feet or more.
Yeah, when I first moved here, they said it was sort of an unlimited aquifer, and then all of a sudden it came to be that it was not unlimited. We were in danger of running out.
Yeah, and there was this real shift in the science in the 1980s and in the policy followed in the 1990s that it really wasn't unlimited and we really needed to do two things. We needed to conserve water, and we needed to shift our water supply away from pumping groundwater to use imported Colorado River Basin water. And we did that in 2008. We completed the San Juan Chama Drinking Water Project, which takes water imported from the Colorado River Basin, from the San Juan River, beneath the Continental Divide and puts it in the Chama River and the Rio Grande. And that provides sort of the backbone of our drinking water supply now and greatly reducing our use of groundwater. In the decade since we made that switch, made the switch in late 2008, so close to a decade, the aquifer beneath the city has recovered 15, 20, 25 feet in various places around the city.
Why does it recover?
Water is constantly flowing into the aquifer, primarily from the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande and the groundwater are connected.
Uh-huh.
So as we reduce our pumping, more water flows in from the Rio Grande and is refilling the aquifer. And at the same time we made that policy change, the shift in our source of water, and we spent a lot of money to do this, $500 million. At the same time we did that, we also engaged in a really aggressive conservation program. And this is the remarkable thing. And Albuquerque is a remarkable case. But as I traveled around the West, we find that Albuquerque is not unique in this regard. Our per capita water use has essentially been cut in half. We used to use around 250 gallons per person per day in the mid-1990s. Today, it's around 125 to 130 gallons per person per day.
So in your book, you sort of describe Albuquerque is the exemplar for the West.
And Albuquerque is
really doing well.
Albuquerque is one of the best conservation success stories in the Western United States.
And why is Albuquerque better than other cities?
I think that's an interesting question. That's one of the things now in my new academic role that I think myself and my students are really interested in working on is trying to understand that. We had really aggressive policies, lawn buyback programs, toilet rebates. We had an aggressive advertising and marketing and education campaign by the water utility. You know, every fourth grader in Albuquerque gets a water education, so that generation moves up. And we had this consciousness change in the culture as a whole. People's attitudes toward water changed from one of profligate use to one of conservation. But if you look at cities across the West, everybody's doing this. We're doing it better than everyone else.
I was amazed by what you said about Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Because when you go to Las Vegas, I'm sure most people have either gone there or seen it. It looks like they couldn't care less about water usage.
Yeah, and in fact, Las Vegas is also a water conservation model. They haven't done as well as we have, but they've done pretty well. Phoenix is the same thing. Denver is the same thing. Los Angeles and San Diego, Tucson, all these big Western cities are similar to the extent that even as population continues to grow in these cities, total water use. I'm not talking about per capita. We're talking about the total water use is going down in every single one of these cities.
So that's really amazing.
Yeah.
I have just a related environmental question, and it may be out of your area, but as we take out grass and we substitute like dirt and rocks, what about all the creatures that live in the grass?
Yeah, that's an interesting problem.
Feed off the creatures that live in the grass.
That's an interesting problem that's not really well understood. We're changing these urban ecosystems now, and I don't think it's a big research project in Phoenix to look at that. Nancy Grimm, who's a faculty member both at Arizona State and here at the University of New Mexico, has worked on that. And I don't understand it as well here in Albuquerque.
One of the things I notice, I live in North Valley. I mean, as I travel from the city to North Valley, the temperature drops like 10 degrees.
Yeah. When you have all that lawn, when you have all those trees, it cools off the city. And so that's one of the challenges as we shift away from lawns, especially the cities get hotter. That urban, you know, all that dumping all that water on the land does reduce the urban heat island effect. So there's some challenges with finding the new sort of normal as we use less water.
So I have a really basic question about the San Juan diversion project.
Yeah.
Which is that I've always read that there's no more available water. How was Albuquerque able to get water that it didn't have before? because I thought all the water was already allocated.
That water was set aside for New Mexico in the mid-1950s with the Colorado River Storage Project Act. We had it on paper. We just weren't using it in this way. So we've had it since the project was completed in the Congress authorized the project in the 1950s, was completed in the early 1970s. So that water's been available to us for a while. It was just a choice of how to go about using it.
So we're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, I want to talk to you about agricultural water use. We are back on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio Professor John Fleck. And John has written a very interesting book called Waters for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West. And you know, one of the things I find in TV, radio, even newspapers is that there's so much of a concentration on urban use of water, and there's very little concentration on agricultural use of water. It's not true of your book. You spend a lot of time on agricultural use. But the big kahuna is agricultural use, right? What, like in New Mexico, how much is percent, what would be the percentage of agriculture versus urban?
It depends on the place and the area you are, but typically across the West, and New Mexico is no different, somewhere between 70% and 80% of the water used by humans. So this is water taken out of the rivers and the groundwater to use, for human use. 70% to 80%, sometimes more, sometimes less, is used for agriculture. We use that water to grow food, and that's what we originally, as the European immigrants pushed the Indians aside and settled the Western United States. That was our intention. We thought of this as a potential farmland and irrigation agriculture being the sort of foundation of the communities that we wanted to build here.
So, you know, so you have said that in the last 2 decades, Albuquerque's cut its use by 50%. If we could just cut agricultural use by 20%, that would kind of make up for most of urban use total. So the question is, you know, is agricultural use going down, and how much is it going down?
So here in New Mexico, there is certainly a decline in some areas in the middle Rio Grande Valley where Albuquerque sits. Agricultural water use is relatively stable, and there's a reason for that, because what we have here is a legal system that's called the Doctrine of Prior Appropriation, which says the first folks to develop water are the ones who have the sort of most high-priority rights to use water. So this was a farming area before it was a city. The farmers were here first, and they're entitled to use that share of water from the river that they get. And that's why across the West you see so much water in the West Slope of Agriculture, here in West Slope of Colorado, here in Albuquerque, across central Arizona and California, why there is so much water devoted to agriculture, because the farmers were here first. And that's sort of an important cultural principle, right? We don't just shove
people. Well, is it cultural legal? Because, I mean, that you combine with prior appropriation with use it or lose it. Basically, if you don't put it to beneficial use, you lose it.
So
what you're doing is you're saying to people with prior rights, boy, use everything you have or lose it. And there's really not very much incentive, at least in terms of that doctrine, to cut back.
Yeah, the use it or lose it doctrine is it's greatly overrated.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't. In practice, we haven't seen a lot of farmers lose water.
They don't lose it.
Lose water rights because and there are a lot of really creative policy mechanisms that people have used to get around that problem and to enable farmers to use water more efficiently and be compensated and have the water go to other places.
So what are some of those?
So an example of this, the probably the best example of this, is the Palo Verde Irrigation District, which is around Blythe in California on the Colorado River. The oldest water rights, the oldest non-native water rights on the Colorado River, super old water rights. They have developed a collaborative agreement with the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California that allows MET to pay them to fallow fields during drought years, send that water to LA, without them losing their water rights. So they still
so
have
I've read that's a legal
rights.
Issue, though. So if you don't put it to beneficial use, that in some states you still that may not be considered use.
Yeah,
is that true? I don't even know.
That in practice has not been the case.
I see.
And so people have overcome the use it or lose it. It's still widely believed by a lot of farmers that is the situation, and that kind of poses a problem. But what we've seen, beyond these legal questions, is that as water becomes more scarce in places like the West Slope of Colorado and in Southern California and in Arizona, farmers have been willing to and able to do these collaborative deals with cities that allow the farmer to be compensated in a way that makes sense to the farmer, voluntarily relinquishing some of their water for city use in return for some payments, or payments to improve irrigation efficiency with the saved water going to urban users. So that there are a lot of examples of collaborative relationships. And at the same time, because these farmers are smart businessmen and women, they're sometimes shifting crops out of low-value crops like cotton and alfalfa.
Yeah, and
which
you
are
write
big.
About that. Very interesting.
Yeah, switching out of the low-value crops, and they're not making as much money, and there's less water, and they concentrate the water on things like the winter vegetables that, you eat that come from desert irrigation water from the Colorado River. That sort of satisfy the farm economy, the farmer's desire to make a living, and recognize this changing reality, suggesting that, there is, in fact, less water.
Does this collaborative effort, the selling of water, does this happen in New Mexico to any extent?
There is less of it in New Mexico. We're farther behind the other states of the West in developing these mechanisms. And partly it's just because, for two reasons. Here in the middle Rio Grande Valley, which is one of our major areas, it's not really lucrative farming. It's farming as a part of the lifestyle. And it's been the pattern of farming here has long been for people to have a small chunk of land and grow alfalfa or corn or whatever on it and have a job in the city. That's been the norm here going back a century. That's, the common sort of structure of the agricultural economy. There's exceptions when you get down into Valencia County and in Socorro County, and there are a couple of big, commercially farmed properties here in Bernalillo County, but most of the farming is done that way. But this happens, this trading of water between farms and cities happens when the crunch happens, when things get really serious. So you've seen it in Arizona and California. We haven't really had the crunch here yet. Albuquerque has concluded that it can meet its long-term water needs.
I see. So the demand isn't there really...
I mean, Albuquerque has remarkably concluded that it can meet its long-term water needs for most of the rest of the century without ever having to go in and retire agricultural water rights, which didn't used to be the case,
And that's the major metropolitan area.
Right. So you still see a little bit of buying up of water rights by Rio Rancho and Santa Fe.
And I've heard numbers like $12,000 an acre foot to buy water.
Yeah, that's $12,000 for a permanent acre foot right.
Yeah, that's a permanent right.
Yeah, it's not a single year acre foot.
So it's valuable stuff.
So it's it's valuable stuff. Yeah,
and that really brings up another question I have in this general area, which is, this is what I've read that. The water's almost free to agricultural users. Now, to metropolitan users, the water itself isn't charged. There's no charge for that. But all the plumbing, if you will, to get the water to the user and to clean it and purify it and all, that's substantial. So that's a disincentive to overuse. But that with agricultural users, there isn't much of a financial disincentive. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Farm water is really cheap in the West.
I'm sorry?
Farm water is really cheap in the West.
Really cheap. So, again, you have a lot of perverse incentives if what you want to do is save on water.
Yeah. Yeah, economists roll their eyes. My faculty appointment is in the Department of Economics here, and talk to the economists about this, and there's some eye-rolling about that. But it is the way it is. It's, that's the way we did it.
And I suppose that charging for water would be a non-starter in the legislature, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, maybe you could give incentives, tax incentives, to use less water, right? There might be some economic way to change it. But other countries like Australia have been effective at putting charges on water, right?
Yeah, it's certainly one approach that could be used.
We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. We are back on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio UNM Professor John Fleck. Professor Fleck has written a book about water. He talks about the myth of fighting over water. And as I indicated at the top of the show, I sort of wanted to push back on that. And actually, one of my sources for pushing back on it is your book, because... Because you outlined several potential significant disputes that could arise, and I wonder if you could just mention some of those.
Well, so there are a number of... No, my book is about the Colorado River Basin as a whole.
That's right.
There are a number of unresolved legal questions about who's entitled to have to how much water. Some of them involve the United States and Mexico and situations of extreme drought. Some of them involve how much water the states of the upper Colorado River Basin, including New Mexico, are required to deliver to the states of the lower basin, which is Nevada and Arizona and California. Important unresolved legal questions that have the potential to lead to significant litigation that poses enormous risk to water users in whatever region loses the lawsuit.
Well, let's just talk about that, the obligation of the so-called upper basin states to supply, I think it's 7.5 million acre-feet of water to the lower basin states.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be, and the river has been short, as I understand it, for years and years and years, and it's predicted to get shorter in terms of water. So that could be a major litigation problem, right?
That's an enormous litigation risk. To the states of the upper basin, but also to the states of the lower basin, depending on how the courts decide and what the judgment might be. Whoever loses that litigation has the potential to lose a great deal. That's why I believe that, and this belief is based on the time I've spent over the last 5 years working with, talking to, interviewing, and now in my academic career being a participant in these discussions among the senior leadership of the Colorado River Basin, and there's a general shared agreement that that's a litigation that nobody wants to start because the risk of losing it is so high and that we are far better off negotiating compromises that that find ways to split the difference between the legal positions of the two sides on this. And that's the sort of dominant part of the process
Now, I spent my whole life doing litigation, and I would just say that what you're outlining is exactly the position in any litigation. That is, when you have something huge at stake and you don't know what the outcome is going to be, and you could lose a lot in the litigation, there is a real impetus to compromise. On the other hand, that compromise has to be based on the legal rights in the underlying agreement, and it looks like the lower basin states have a much stronger position than the upper basin states because there's actually a specific amount of water that is supposed to be delivered.
That's certainly the argument that the lawyers in the lower basin make. But the lawyers in the upper basin have a couple of other arguments. One is the language of the Colorado River Compact. It doesn't say the upper basin states are required to deliver 7.5 million acre feet. What it says is the states of the upper basin shall not deplete below 7.5 million acre feet. So the lawyers for the upper basin, who are clever lawyers, will argue that, in fact, it's not their depletions on the river, it's climate change, it's drought and climate change.
It's the absence of water in the river.
Right. It's the absence of water in the river itself. So, and this is a fundamentally unresolved legal question.
It's a
good argument.
Yeah.
I happen to think the lawyers in the lower basin probably have the better of that argument. But the fact remains that there is enough uncertainty that people have looked at various ways of sort of splitting that difference, from finding ways to conserve water in the lower basin such that their risks are lower, finding ways to conserve water in the upper basin, and so that every – and it's this ethos of shared sacrifice because it's a belief that we are all the victims of two things. One is a mistake in the way the Colorado River water was allocated back in 1922. They made the mistake.
Sort of mistaken assumption, which is another legal argument.
Right. And that's sort of part of it. But also there's this idea that climate change has now changed everything. And this understanding that success happens through shared sacrifice rather than conflict. Because the conflict, you know, these Supreme Court lawsuits take a long time. Tremendous uncertainty has tremendous impact on the economies of all the states of the basin. While they are going on, and you have seen this historically with the litigation in Arizona versus California, which really hamstrung development in both states because nobody was sure how much water they were going to have to work with.
So let me just ask you maybe quickly about a current litigation, which is Texas versus New Mexico. And that's recently, the Supreme Court's allowed that to go forward. And Texas's argument is, I think, since 1939, when the Rio Grande Compact was entered into, there's been all this population increase and all this agricultural increase. And so, therefore, water that's supposed to be delivered from Elephant Butte to the Texas border is being intercepted and diverted for other uses. And they're saying that they have a claim on all that water that's being diverted. And people have told me that they think Texas has a good claim because the lower basin people usually win. But I don't see that. It seems to me to be obvious that population was going to increase, agricultural use was going to increase. There's nothing in the agreement that prevents the use of that water, diverting that water. So what's your take on that one?
Well, first of all, I would say that Texas versus New Mexico litigation right now is the single best argument against my thesis that water's not for fighting over, right? I mean, it's
I was going to start with that one.
Yeah, it's for fighting over down there.
Yeah.
And I think the legal questions and the hydrology that underlies the legal questions are, extremely arcane and difficult to parse in a way that would allow me to make any kind of a prediction about how the courts might rule. I mean, New Mexico has a very clear legal argument that we're meeting our delivery obligations.
Because it's under a percentage, the and we're saying we meet the percent.
It's the delivery. Here's the core of the legal argument. The Rio Grande Compact requires us to deliver a percentage of the river's flow. But it doesn't require us to deliver it at the Texas line. It requires us to deliver it at Elephant Butte Reservoir. And we are meeting that delivery obligation at Elephant Butte Reservoir. We release the water down the Rio Grande, and then there is groundwater pumping in the lower Rio Grande. I was just down there driving through the Hatch Valley yesterday. It's just gorgeous down there. Beautiful pecan farms, and they pump groundwater. Texas argues that in pumping that groundwater, we're stealing Texas's water. So it's an arcane argument about whether that groundwater pumping should count against our compact allegation or not, that the judges will resolve. And if we lose, New Mexico, especially that farming in the lower Rio Grande, is going to really be on the hook for a lot of money or a lot of water, really, really harmful. But this goes to the underlying argument that I make about the advantage of a collaborative and cooperative agreement.
So that's what I really want to get to, because we're nearing the end of the show. And what I want to get from you is just your overall take, so listeners hear it, on whether these various potential disputes and actual disputes are going to have real-world effects in the near term. Do you really foresee these disastrous consequences, which, as you say, were predicted in Cadillac Desert, but so far haven't come about. Do you foresee any of those coming about in the near term?
No, I don't. And what we see, and you can see this in California, especially with their disastrous drought of the last 5 years, is this enormous, significant adaptive capacity that communities have when stressed to use less water. We saw California very successfully weather what arguably was the driest 5 years in 1,000 years. We saw communities that had already conserved water conserve more. We saw farm communities, some we saw behave badly by just overpumping aquifers. We saw a lot of farm communities switch out crops, reduce the low-value crops, and succeed in surviving. we have seen the establishment and the use of a whole new set of tools to collaborate with water, to use less water, that Mark Reisner in Cadillac Desert in the 1980s never really envisioned. He saw population growing and water running out. He didn't see, he couldn't have seen, this adaptive capacity that's been enormously successful and that has kind of laid the groundwork for a path. We still could crash, but the crash only comes if we fail to recognize these really important and valuable lessons about how to succeed in using less water.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I would like to thank my guests today so much, UNM Professor John Fleck. Professor Fleck has written a book called Water in the West.
Water is for fighting over.
Water is for fighting over.
And other myths about water in the West.
About water in the West. I'd also like to thank my engineer today, Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Chebecki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of the show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Great. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it.
That lower Rio Grande stuff is just hairy complicated.
Yeah.
It was really frustrating to me to write in the newspaper to try to condense it to 600 or 1,000 words.
Yeah, and actually the recent they're doing a decent job on it, but I didn't think there was much detail in the recent.
It's just hard to write enough detail to make sense of the complexities.
Yeah, and you know there was one. There was another article on the Mesilla. I was going to ask you I don't even know how to pronounce it. Mesilla Bolson.
Mesilla Bolson.
It's the Y.
Lauren Villagran. Villagran did those.
You know, and this sort of the thrust of it seemed to be Mexico is taking our water, but I mean we're using more water in Las Cruces than now that they're even taking out of it. And it's always kind of a one-sided perspective of, you know, it's really our water. Yeah. And why are they taking it away from us? Yeah. But
it was great stuff. Thanks.
It was good to have you here.
That was fun.
So the show will air the first Friday in August,
it's the 5th.
Whatever that is. I think it's like August 4th or 5th.
The 4th, maybe.
Yeah.
4th or 5th, yeah.
So at 8 o'clock.
Cool.
And then if my stepson ever gets around to doing it, it'll be at iTunes. he's busy.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you very much, John. Thanks for coming in. You look really tan, by the way.
I've been out in the sun. I've been riding my bike a lot. But, yeah, we laid by the pool.
If I could just get one more listener, namely you. He was very soft-spoken. I guess you can adjust that in the volume, right? Yeah. I just made a couple changes in the intro. My it's so crushed out. It's All right, let me give it a shot, okay? Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, does New Mexico face an imminent water crisis, or are all those ominous headlines just an attempt to get our attention? We'll ask UNM professor and former Albuquerque Journal water reporter John Fleck, author of Water is for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West. Professor John Fleck, welcome to the program. You want me to do it one more time? What do you think? Yeah, it was okay. I think I might be able to do it slightly better. Usually if I get all the words right, then I can do it. Okay. Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, does New Mexico face an imminent water crisis, or are all those ominous headlines just an attempt to get our attention? We'll ask UNM professor and former Albuquerque Journal water reporter John Fleck, author of Water is for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West. Professor John Fleck, welcome to the program. I just messed up. I can just say, Professor John Fleck, welcome to the program. Can you clean that up? Okay. So now the end, right? I messed up the title of his book is what I did. Maybe I won't mention the book again. I'll just thank him. Okay. All right, I'll mention the book. You're the boss, Ramon. Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, UNM Professor John Fleck, author of the book, Water in the... Oh, God, darn it, why can't I do this? Sorry, let me start again. Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, UNM Professor John Fleck, author of the book, Water is for Fighting Over... Why don't I just say author? Let me just start one more time. Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, UNM Professor John Fleck, author of Water is for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West. Thanks also to my engineer, Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time. One slight bobble, but I don't think it was significant. Skipped on iTunes. Okay, start. Do it again? Okay. I'm hurrying. I should slow down. Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank today's guest, Professor John Fleck, author of Water is for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West. Thanks also to my engineer, Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time. I think that's adequate. Megan had emailed me about the show, and somehow she said she was going to talk to Tristan. She wasn't even aware that there was a promo somehow. I have no idea. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, Roman, in terms of getting people to play the promo. Okay. I'll email him or something. I'm sure he's gone by now. But, I mean, some of the promos air over and over and over again. And I just, you know, I would just like a few. So let me just try one. I'll try one run through. Let me just try it on my own, just see how long it is. Yes, looks like I have plenty of time. Okay. Is New Mexico really in danger of running out of water? I'm Stephen Spitz, the host of New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas, and this Friday morning at 8, we'll learn all about water with UNM professor and former Albuquerque Journal water reporter John Fleck, author of Water is for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West, this Friday morning at 8 on KUNM. I think I could possibly do it better, but you're undecided. Okay, I'll do it. That's a good clue. I didn't get through to my audience. Can I go ahead? Yeah. Is New Mexico really in danger of running out of water? I'm Stephen Spitz, the host of New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas, and this Friday morning at 8, we'll learn all about water with UNM professor and former Albuquerque Journal water reporter John Fleck, author of Water is for Fighting Over and Other Myths About Water in the West, Friday morning at 8 on KUNM.